Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's give a warm Tulare County welcome for our warm-up speaker, Carol.
Okay. Oh. Hi, my name is Carol and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is November 1st. I almost forgot. November 1st, 1971, which means I'm 44 years sober. I'm 79 years old, and I'm a bitch. Just so you know. I was third choice for this, so, you know. Called me yesterday and left a message and said, could you be my warm-up speaker? And he knew I was coming, so, and I could sit here and give you 15 minutes worth of a report on Craig, Kirk, what the hell your name is, where did you go? The fun part about being sober a long time is you get to watch people get sober and fight the program and fight themselves and ultimately decide that they'd rather live than die. And I've been able to do that with Kirk. We poke at him and slap him around a bit, and he likes it, so... You guys will have to deal with that part of it. It's none of my business. But basically, my drinking started when I was 16. I was a blackout drinker from the get-go. I was at a slumber party, and it was the first time in my life that I got to have all I wanted. And what I understand is that I blacked out, sat in the corner, and grinned for the rest of the evening. And that was probably the last time I was cheerful as a drunk. I don't remember it. I'm a bar drinking slut, and I'm not. I qualify that with I'm not sure. That's embarrassing to say, but I drank in bars from the time I was 17 till I was 35, and I always blacked out, and I always said, this time it's going to be different. I'm not going to drink so much that I don't remember the evening, and I did it anyway because I'm a good alcoholic. And I discovered I had a lot of fun in early drinking. I got hit by a drunk driver when I was 21 years old, went to Europe for a year, and drank my way through many countries and some guys and stuff, and tried to commit suicide once in Spain because it was 1959 and I thought I was pregnant, and you know, you don't come back to Fresno pregnant, unmarried from some guy in Spain. So I planned to kill myself, and I went out in the Mediterranean and I walked and I walked and I walked. And the water came up to here, and then down to here, and up to here, and down to here. I think I walked a mile out in that damn ocean, and I turned around and I said, oh shit, I'm going to have to walk an awful long way back there, so I guess I wasn't really ready to die. And I ended up not being pregnant, so that was all a good thing, and I drank some more, and I discovered actually in Europe that I could drink and have fun and I could be whoever I wanted to be because they didn't know me. When I got back to Fresno, I had to go back to being me. So I had to drink more and go to more bars, and they got sleazier and sleazier as I drank. And I came to that point in my 30s that I had had enough. And I said to God one night, I was sitting in my bed, and I said, God, either let me die or find me some help because I can't do this anymore. And my higher power showed me Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I got here, I was fortunate enough to be done so far. I have not had to go out and drink again. I have had to work the steps over and over and over again. To me, I think, you know, there are bajillions of people that need this program and a lot of people that want this program, but the only ones that seem to get it are the ones that are willing to get down on their knees and ask something outside themselves to help them and then read that book and work those steps. I still have a sponsor, and my sponsor has a sponsor, and I have a 10-step I had to write this last week because I had a resentment that I was ready to hurt somebody. And my instincts told me, rip them a new one. And my higher power went, don't be doing that. So I just sat and patted my resentment. I just loved that little sucker for days. A friend gave me a little stuffed kitty so that I could have something actually to rub. That's the kind of friends I have. And then I had to do the footwork. I had to do the written 10-step. I got to write the F-U letter, which I endure, you know, tell them what that asshole did and why I have this resentment and yada, yada, yada. And then I have to get to the part is, what's my part in this? What do I need to do to get to the point where I don't want to kill that person? And it came. I haven't gotten to give it to my sponsor yet because she lives out of town and I haven't gotten a hold of her yet. But the reality of it is, if I do the footwork, my life gets better. If I go to meetings, my life gets better. If I work with other people, my life gets better. And I'm a greedy bitch. I want more. These people that say that sobriety is enough for them, bless them. I want more. I'm greedy. I want it all. I want everything I can get out of this program. And it has allowed me, for many, lo, these many years, to be able to live in my own skin with a great deal of peace most of the time. There are still people out there that I would like to run over with a Mack truck, but they won't let me drive one, so, you know, you guys are safe. My higher power has put provisions in my life to help me not hurt myself. I came in here, a piece of something stuck in the bottom of somebody's shoe, and that's how I felt. And I thought it would never be different. And I looked at you people and I thought, God, you've got it, but I don't think I can. I don't think I have what it takes to stay sober. And you guys grabbed a hold of me and said, come on, dummy. Stick with us. Just follow us. And I did. I ran in a pack of about 20 people, and of those 20 people, the ones that are still alive are still sober, and the ones that are dead died sober. And that is something I wasn't planning on. I was not planning on being here this long, number one. I was a drunk, blackout driver. And, of course, in my day, the cops would pull you over and say, go home, honey. And so I got away with a lot of crap for a long time. Today, I'd have been in jail in a heartbeat because I thought when I was drunk, I could drive wonderfully well. Now, I know I'm a crappy driver, but I figure you guys are on your own. I'm sober. You do what you have to out there. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, it's just, you know, the older you get, the less you give a really rat's ass what's happening around you. Now, if you want to be a dumbass, go ahead, be one. I don't care. I don't want to be. I've learned through working the steps 1 through 12 again and again and again that I don't like not liking me. I would rather like you. It's not a requirement. I have to love you. I when they say that, I think, well, do I really love them? Well, I have to act like I love them anyway. I don't have to like them all. I don't have to run with them all. I have choices today. I have a choice to drink today if I want to, but it's not something I want to do today. Who knows tomorrow? But if I stay within the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and if I stick with you people on a regular basis, and if I am a part of what Alcoholics Anonymous is about, I will probably stay sober. That's it's kind of sort of a promise. The book has promises, and I love that. You promise an alcoholic something, you better pay, come through with it, or you're going to pay for it. They didn't tell me I didn't have to work. They didn't tell me I wouldn't have tough stuff in my life. But they told me that if I did what they did, then I wouldn't have to drink again, and I wouldn't have to feel like that about myself again. Or not for very long anyway. I don't suffer well. I'm a whiner, a snivel. I hate whiners and snivelers, just to let you know. And a clinger. I have a twitch. I don't have a twitch when people start clinging to me. So I always get the clingers and the hard heads and the cement heads. God just has a sense of humor. My higher power has a sense of humor, and he lets me get them put in my life. I mean, they just got to drill holes in the cement just to pound a little sense into them. They had to do it to me. And that's what I love about this program. I don't tell you to do anything I don't have to do. I don't give you my opinion. I share my experience, strength, and hope. And I share the crap. When I was about 15 years sober, I thought, you know, I'm too long sober. I can't be miserable, rotten jerk off that these other people are. I can't do that. I'm too long sober. And I started closing down and almost drank. That's the only time so far in sobriety that I almost drank, because I would not be honest with another human being until I could get honest with myself. And when I did that, then I could, you know, throw up all over you, and you guys had to say, oh, God. It's okay, it's okay. You'll be okay. You know, I'll always pat on your head now and again. Oh. Oh, baby. Oh, that's the sad, poor thing. Scary thing. Oh, dear me. Anyway, today I am grateful to be amongst my own kind. I'm grateful that my friend asked me to come up here and do this, down here, aren't we? And that I can watch him grow. He's just celebrated 5 years, same month I did, November. Four? Where'd that one go? See? I missed that one. Anyway, I have been allowed to just about go anywhere I want to go and do anything I want to do. I've learned that through sobriety, that I can have adventures. I'm not afraid to do anything anymore. Worst case scenario, people were kind of laughing at me the other day because in Fresno on Wednesday night, I went to dinner with some friends and we were going to go to a meeting and it was raining cats and dogs. And I come out of the restaurant and there's this flood out there and I thought, I'll tippy-toe around it. And nobody, you know, I'll get my feet a little wet, no big deal. Flat out, on the face. Water from head to toe. And I'm laying there and going, help, I've fallen and I can't get up. And nobody's around. And I said, oh shit, I'm going to have to get myself up, aren't I? So I got up and my friend who was walking by, it was against his deaf ear. So I said, Jim, honey, would you tell him I'm not coming to the meeting? He says, why not? I said, I fell in the water. He says, oh, okay. Concerned friend that I've had for 35 years, you know. So tough love, sometimes you get in Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes you get the gentle, loving kind. I'm not a gentle, loving kind. People who want me to sponsor, my number one, I said, are you alcoholic? Yeah. Are you nuts? Yeah. You think there is something out there beside yourself? Yeah, now do your 4-step. And that's the quickest way in the world for them to get away. They just go, oh, you mean I can't do this 9 months, 100 years down the road? I'm a believer in you do it now. Bill and Bob used to do them in the hospital when they weren't even sober yet. So I'm a believer in getting on with the steps, because if you don't, you might not make it. And I don't want to not make it. And I, like I said, people like Kurt, when you care about somebody, it hurts you when they go back out there and put themselves in harm's way. And so we'll love you until you can love yourself, or even like yourself, or even do something better for yourself. We will. That's what we're here for. I'm here to stay sober, primarily. And whatever else I have to give, I'm grateful to give it. I don't want to be special or wonderful. Like I say, I warn people. I was sick for 3 weeks at Christmas time. I got broken in my house, got broken into, and then I got sick. And I said, that little shit left his germs in my house and made me sick. I was just crazy. And it's little shit poured honey over my Christmas tree ornaments. I'm going, I hope you're an addict and you don't get clean. I'm narrow. I'm very narrow. And this sweet kid in the program said, you know, I'm an alcoholic and an addict. And he says, you know what would be worse? And I said, what? For him to get clean and then have to go by your house every day and know that he broke into your house. And he's going to have to clean it up sometime. And I go, ooh, that's better. I can be mean-spirited. But fortunately, I don't have to drink over stuff. I can whine and snivel and bitch and gripe and do whatever I have to do and then do the footwork. I do that always so that I don't have to lose what I've got today. And if you are new or fairly new and you feel like a piece of shit or that life sucks with sharp teeth, it probably does. And it will again, even when it cleans up. It does. You know, life happens. I thought when I got sober that, you know, everything would be wonderful forever and ever and amen. And I forgot that life keeps happening, whether I'm drunk or whether I'm sober. The difference is that when I am sober, I can deal with that stuff. I don't have to kill me or you, and I get to be okay with me. My higher power trusts me to sometimes to actually do what I'm supposed to do. I ask every day for another day of sobriety. I thank him every night for another day of sobriety. I have no guarantee. I used to love to tell my friend, you can always drink tomorrow. And she said, oh, okay. She didn't realize that it's always today. So I want to thank Kirk for asking me and for you all being here, and I'll have a happy new year. Thank you.
I want to thank everybody for showing up. And let's give a warm Tulare County welcome for our featured speaker, Kirk.
Hi, everybody. I'm Kirk, and I'm an undeniable alcoholic. And I want to kind of elaborate on the undeniable part. The reason I use that phrase is because before I could fully concede and in surrender to this program, denial was a big part of my struggles out there. So I hear about a grateful alcoholic and hope to die alcoholic and things like that, but I'm an undeniable alcoholic. That's what I'm kind of hanging my hat on tonight. So anyways, I'd like to thank Rick for asking me to come up and speak here tonight, and also want to thank him for asking me a full 6 months ago to give me plenty of time to think about what I'm going to say and worry and create anxiety and remind myself about that one part in the book that the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind. So it's been a lot of thinking and a lot of planning. The outcome kind of reminds me of that. It's kind of an icebreaker joke. If you ever want to let God know, ever want to make God laugh or smile, get up in the morning and tell him what your plans are for the day. Anyways, my God-given sobriety date is November 4th, 2011. Kind of doing things a little backwards here tonight. We have 44 years going in front of 4 years. But I had a hard time kind of wrapping my brain around that whole concept of God-given sobriety date. It was just kind of, I would kind of scoff at that notion that, what does the God-given sobriety date have to do with it? That's the day you put the plug in the jug, and that's the day you stop drinking and you move forward from there. But that was, that was early on in my sobriety, and that was when I was struggling. And I didn't understand that until I personally tried my own sobriety dates. And, that led me to be a chronic and repeat newcomer. So, now I understand what that God-given sobriety date truly means. I want to welcome, was it Kenya, the newcomer? Kina? Welcome. You are the, in my delusional, egotistical mind, I thought I was the most important person in the room tonight, but you are the most important person in the room tonight. My illustrious drinking career began when I was 15 years old. I grew up in a normal, highly functioning family. I'm the only one in the family to be afflicted with this disease, and I was kind of condemning towards God for that. For a while, I was a little bit kind of like, why me? Why am I the chosen one? That sucks. Why do I have to be the one to have this this fatal disease? But what I had to do is just accept the fact that that I have the disease and kind of move forward from there. But I have two brothers and a sister, and I grew up in the Bay Area, and there are no drugs or alcohol or abuse issues in my family growing up, and my first experience with alcohol was we were on a family vacation. I grew up in the Bay Area. We were driving down to Mexico, and it's a long drive, so we stopped in Mission Beach down in San Diego area. We stayed overnight there, and we had been kind of cooped up in a car all the way down. It was like 7-hour drive, so My sister and I was 15 at the time, she was 17, and we decided to go to, they had like a little arcade by the beach, so we decided to go to this arcade and just kind of mess around and, you know, get away from our parents and get away from the family and just kind of chase around down there. And so we're down there messing around at the arcade, and you know, she's you know, a good looking 17 year old teenage girl, and so two guys decide to kind of make a play on my sister right in front of me. So they're kind of hitting on her, and you know, next thing you know, they're talking about where they can score beer, and you know, let's go down to the beach and hang out and drink beer. So somehow they scored a couple cases of, I remember it was Budweiser's, and they were not twist offs because I still have a chip on my front tooth from cracking open those beer bottles. But so we go down to the beach, and you know, so these two, you know, players had hidden motives evidently, so they're trying to get the annoying kid brother out of the way as quickly as possible. So what they're doing is just handing me beer after beer after beer, you know, get the annoying younger brother out of the way. So you know, I just kept pounding them, you know, cracking them off with not being twist offs. And next thing I know, for some reason, this is right about the time that Bruce Jenner had got all his gold medals in the Olympics. So we're down there on the beach, and for some reason I had this crazy thought that I was Bruce Jenner, and I wanted to go look for my gold medals somewhere down there on the beach. So, you know, it's late at night, and I'm telling them that I have a gold medal somewhere, and they're telling me to get away. Okay, they're way down by the pier. Go down by the pier and go find them. So I'm cruising down there. I don't want this to be misconstrued for the current present-day Caitlyn Jenner. We're talking Bruce Jenner here. That's a whole different 12-step deal. That's, you know, self-identity anonymous or something going on there. But so I'm thinking I'm Bruce Jenner, and I need to go find my gold medals that are hidden somewhere down on Mission Beach. And so they're telling me, you know, eventually they tell me they're in the ocean. And so I'm in a full parka, fully dressed, and so I'm diving down in the ocean looking for these gold medals in a complete blackout. And next thing I remember, I'm passed out on the beach, and car pulls up with headlights onto me, and it's my mom and my sister had found me passed out on the beach, and they kind of resuscitate me and bring me into the car, and I'm in the back seat of the car, and my sister's next to me, and I just remember my mom's purse being right in front of me, and my mom turning around saying, "Has he been drinking tonight?" And my sister said, "No," and I threw up right into her purse behind the seat there. And so that was, you know, that was my first experience drinking, and that was, you know, potentially, you know, diving in the ocean and the, you know, fully dressed and all that was like a, you know, very risky. And there's a part in Bill's story where it talks about Bill, in Bill's story where he's driving by a cemetery and he sees a tombstone and it says something about, "Here dies a Hampshire Grenadier, died drinking too much beer." And then below it, it says, "An ominous warning which I failed to heed." And that's kind of a repeat theme in my story. There are many ominous warnings which I failed to heed due to my drinking. And I, you know, Webster's defines ominous as having the impression that something bad or unpleasant is about to happen. So, you know, I had many ominous warnings which I failed to heed, and that my first drinking experience was one of them. So this was right before high school, and then, you know, I get into high school and I start hanging out with the, you know, with the athletes and the jocks, and we're trying to you know, avoid the parents, so we're doing the house parties at whoever's parents were gone and doing all that kind of stuff and going and parking late at night and drinking beer late at night. And I remember it, in high school, my drinking was beginning to progress, although it didn't get to the point, you know, it hadn't progressed to the point to where it developed into problems. This was the first stage of fun. It hadn't got to the problems yet. And I just remember there were certain signs in high school of my friends, like when we would go out, they would say, "Oh, Kirk's coming with us. We need to buy twice as much." And, man, dude, you're short. How do you drink it so fast? You know, you're going 2-1 on me. Just certain red flags, you know, things that I ignored and just laughed it off. And throughout high school, I was able to, for some reason, it didn't progress to the point to where it affected my grades yet. Affected, you know, those things that I looked for, you know, tried to excel in. So I graduated from high school, and then at this point my drinking really excelled, because after high school I went to UCLA and got into the Greek system. And, you know, for anybody that's an alcoholic in training, to go to UCLA and be in the Greek system, that's a great training grounds. There's a lot of keg parties, a lot of drinking in that environment. But one thing that really, kind of heightened my drinking is I was no longer at home. I no longer had that accountability, that responsibility. My brother was 4 years older than me, and so at that, way back then, when you turn in your driver's license, when you get a new driver's license, you don't have to turn in your old one. So when I was 17, I had a fake ID that looked, you know, identical to me. So I was able to, you know, it was a huge enabling device that enabled me to, from 17 on, to drink legally and buy for everybody. And when I was in college, that was when the problems really developed. That was when the legal problems started to develop. The isolation. I lived with guys that we would, go to the frat parties, and for some reason I got appointed this position of the keg master. So I was at these frat parties, and I was basically pouring one for you and one for me, manning the keg, sitting by the keg. So most of the people are, 6'4", 6'5", and here's this guy, 5'6", by the keg, going 1-1, basically just drinking three times as much as anyone else. And, in college is when I started to withdraw and isolate from social things. We would play darts for tequila in the apartment before we even went out. And, I remember not joining them towards the end of my drinking days. And, you know, they would go out and I would stay home, and I would continue drinking and isolating and drinking by myself into that blackout stage, to that point of, this is the point in college is where alcohol ceased to become a luxury. It became a necessity. I had to drink to survive. You know, it was no longer an option. I had to drink just to, be able to stop the shakes. I was drinking in the shower occasionally, just so I, if I shaved, I wouldn't massacre myself up from shaking so bad. It was that, to that point, to where it was drinking to live and living to drink. And still at this point, I still thought I had things under control. And it was kind of scary, because my grades still hadn't been negatively affected by my chronic alcoholism. And I decided to go on to the next step, and I went to, I attempted law school. So I went to law school, and my drinking just continued at this point. And I had no off switch. You know, there was no point to where I tapered down my drinking. I had no reason to. I got 3 DUIs during my drinking career, and you know, they're 0.26, 0.28, and 0.30. And, you know, this is one more of those ominous warnings which I failed to heed. I remember going to a special DUI attorney. This is all this guy did was DUIs, and he reviewed my police reports, and you know, in each one of my police reports, they stated that I was reasonably coherent. I was walking the line, and I had such a high tolerance that he read my police reports, and he looked at me and my height and weight, and he said, you know, based on your height and weight and what I'm reading in these BACs in your police reports, you might want to consider that you have a drinking problem. And that pissed me off because I was still at that point of denial. And I remember leaving his office and slamming the door and pissed off that he was judging me to be an alcoholic. You know, how dare he? He doesn't know me. So, you know, I went and drank to my, you know, pissed off attitude towards him. You know, one more ominous warning which I failed to heed. So I still in the back of my mind, I thought, I got this. You know, I can still, I've always wanted to be this, you know, I had this aspiration to be this attorney. So I go to law school, and my end of my first year of law school, I'm drinking pretty heavy in law school, but, you know, I'm barely holding on. It's just barely holding on. I mean, the red flags are coming up. People are starting to, you know, make comments and, you know, things like that. And I remember I finally went to a final exam in law school in a complete blackout. Don't even remember going. And couple days later, they passed out the blue book and the results, and the teacher goes up to the chalkboard and charts the scores, and it goes like 98 down to like 83, and then he draws a line way down, and there was a 9, and that was me. And you know, and I look at the blue book, and I didn't even remember going to the class that night, and don't even remember writing, you know, just and I still wasn't done. You know, I still wasn't done after just trying to hold on. That's all I was doing. And I was drinking to live and living to drink. And so I basically drank myself out of law school. And then, you know, tried to go into the ranks of the employed, even though I was borderline unemployable. So I, you know, I lived down in Orange County at the time, and I remember my first job out of my failed attempt at law school was at a law firm, and I was, it was probably the best job I had while I was drinking. I was a paralegal at this law firm down there in Costa Mesa, right next to South Coast Plaza. It was really, you know, it was a great job, and I remember towards the end of this job, and I felt the heat coming on. I knew that my drinking was interfering with my job, and you know, I was going to pay the consequence. I was going to get fired soon. So I went to their EAP program, their employee assistance program, and you go to a counselor type person, and the guy talks to you, and I remember saying to him, man, I just want to go back to the old times, to where I could just drink with the guys at the bar and high-five them and watch sports and just moderate and control it. And he looked at me and he said, you'll never be able to do that. And that was, I looked upon as like a challenge. So So I went out for 2 more months to try to prove him wrong and try to do that thing that we do, that control and enjoy our drinking, have a few, cut it off, all those various methods we tried. And I'll never forget going back to him 2 months later, and my friends from Fresno can testify to this. When I come back after drinking, the proof is in. The evidence is there. You can tell. I'm like a bloated, red-faced tomato. So, sweating probably too in January or something. So I go back to him 2 months later, and he says to me in that famous piss me off Dr. Phil line, he said, "So how'd that work for you?" You know, and that was one of those, one of those times where I, it hit me square between the eyes, because that's when I, one more time, I realized I cannot control and enjoy my drinking. I cannot just have a few. And, that phenomenon of craving that we read about, and that, once we start, or for me, Einstein has that definition that we use in this program about the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over, knowing what the results are going to be, or expecting different results. But in my case, I would do the same thing over and over, and I knew what the results were going to be, and I didn't care because I didn't have any way to stop, proceeding. I just knew, and I was, it was beyond something that I could control. I had lost all power of choice in my drink. So, I continued to attempt to be employed when I was unemployable, and I had these delusions of, getting these great jobs, and I was like, looking at job listings in the paper and thinking, okay, I'm going to be that, replace Bill Gates as the next guy at Microsoft, and trying to fax resumes when I was shaking so bad I couldn't even hit the buttons on the fax machine, and, still trying to keep it together. And at this point I had accumulated the 3 DUIs, so I was having to go to meetings as a result of that, and, I was going to meetings, forging my court card, showing up to meetings drunk, going into meetings, and it's all I was doing was just going to meetings. And towards the end of my drinking down in Southern California, I lived in Newport Beach on the sand, like 2 houses from Dennis Rodman, and waves crashing against their place. I was living with a topless exotic dancer, and I was trying to get sober, and we had a pool table in the place. So freaking bars would close at 2 a.m., and half of Newport Beach would come back to our house, and crack, pool balls and everything, and I had this job where I had to be there at 7 a.m., and they were all into the dry goods, but I wasn't, but I was just hammered every night, and, partying like a fish down there. And so I thought, I can't stay sober down here. I just can't do it. So I'm gonna pull a geographic. I got family up in Fresno. There's nothing to do up in that dump up there, so I'll move up there. So I move up to Fresno, and you guys know the whole story. Wherever we go, there we are. We take our problems with us. So I go to Fresno, and I just keep drinking. And, I'm going to AA, and I'm making a little more of an effort, but all I'm doing is going to meetings, And one thing I've learned, there's a lot more to this program than just going to meetings. It's called Into Action. There's a whole chapter on it. It's not just into attending meetings. So, I was going to a lot of meetings, and that's all I was doing. But I was drinking in between meetings. I was not working any sort of a program. I was just kind of a occasional meeting attendee. That was my program. And so at the last, I finally in Fresno in 2011, I went on a 9-day isolation drinking binge that basically was the end of my drinking. You know, I blotted it out to the bitter end on this 9-day run. And so I had this apartment in Fresno, and I'm drinking by myself in my recliner, watching ESPN. I turn into a real frugal, cheap drunk, so I'm stuck with natural light beers, you know. I went from, like, Coors, Bud Light, and it kept getting lower and lower to natural light, maybe occasionally a Coors if I got a tax return or, you know, some sort of money came my way somehow. But it was natural light in my apartment by myself on my recliner watching ESPN, and at this time I was doing that Obama unemployment things to where I was just collecting unemployment and using my unemployment to drink, and they kept giving extensions, you know, like 6-month extensions. So I would literally drink in my apartment and watch CNN and MSNBC and watch Congress debate the extension. Be like, yeah, 6 more months. Damn, I love Congress, man. So I'm like watching Congress talk about me spending my unemployment to drink and cheering them on. It was like a football game for me, you know. And if the yeas outweighed the nays and I got 6 more months, I'd love Congress, man. I would drink to Congress, man. MSNBC and CNN. So I'm in my apartment just drinking by myself, ceasing all communication from the outside world. Caller ID is a magical thing when you're a practicing drunk, you know. You know people you do or don't want to answer to and stuff. So I'm in there just drinking, and so I decide to, you know, like I earlier said, I turn into a cheap drunk. So at this point, I'm basically blacking out and coming to 2 or 3 times a day. And, you know, and I'm still doing, you know, I'm still driving in during these drinking periods. And, you know, I just remember coming to, I would get in these crazy modes at night to where I would, like, I would clip coupons in a blackout. I'm kind of embarrassed to say, but I would literally be like 0.25 and risk getting a 2-for-1 superstar burger driving at night. And I'd come to in the morning and there'd be like burger coupons on the floor. And I was clipping coupons in these blackout drunken phases. And then, you know, this is all going on in this last 9-day run. And so, you know, I had plenty of food in the house and beer and everything, thanks to these, you know, Obama unemployment extensions. And so I have this grand idea on a Sunday to go to Costco, because I thought, damn, they got killer samples at Costco. I'm going to go to Costco and I can just get all that tri-tip and all that stuff that they give as samples. So I go to Costco, and it hadn't kicked in completely yet, the complete full effects of the buzz. So I'm at Costco, and like the 11th time at one of the sample tables, the lady's kind of like, hey, you know, this isn't a meal. This is kind of like sampling. And so I remember I get tossed out of Costco for overextending my welcome at the sample table. And so I'm walking out of Costco, and it just hits me, and I start that drunken stagger that we all do when we go from that point of, you know, into that just unbalanced drunken stagger outside. And I'm falling into hedges out in front of Costco. And there was a retired fireman in the parking lot, and I'm trying to look for my car, but I'm falling into hedges, and I got a gash on my forehead, and he says to me, no, dude, you're not finding your car. And so he calls 911, and I'm pleading with him, come on, man, I only live a couple blocks away. So, you know, if you won't let me drive, just give me a ride home. Come on, come on. Next thing I know, the cops and the ambulance both show up, and they say to me, you got a choice. You can go to jail, or you can go to the hospital. And I said, okay, put me on the gurney. I'm going to the hospital. So I go to the hospital, St. Agnes Hospital, and I'm in there, and I still wasn't done yet, and I have an IV in my wrist, and I remember yanking the IV out, blood, you know, squirting up in the air, and saying to the nurse, where's my shirt? I'm out of here. I gotta go. Because I still had like 5 natural lights in the refrigerator. You know, I had to get back home. So I left the hospital against medical advice and, went back home and continued drinking. And then, I'm at home and I'm drinking and I have this idea that, man, every time I leave the house, something bad happens to me, you know. So maybe I'll just kind of stay home and drink and just keep drinking and inside my apartment. And so I'm doing that for the next 2 days and just on the recliner with the remote, just that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization that we get in. And I try to be semi-responsible in its apartment complex. We have a bank of mailboxes. So I go out to check the mail, and adjacent to the mailboxes is our community pool. So I look over at the community pool, and there happened to be an attractive female out there in a bikini, and I'm like wasted. So I think, okay, well, I'll go back to my apartment. I'll get a Sports Illustrated, a Time magazine, maybe like Newsweek or something, look really smart and go sit next to her at the recliner next to her and just start, you know, looking like I'm real sophisticated and intelligent and talk to her. So I go out to the community pool and I'm borderline in a blackout at this point, and I remember leaving there. I don't remember if she told me to leave or if I voluntarily left. But I'm walking back to my apartment, and I hear footsteps, and I look away, and there's mace and pepper spray going into my eyes. So she had come running up, maced and pepper sprayed me in the eyes, and can't even isolate and drink anymore. You know, I go outside, all sorts of problems happen. I try to isolate at home and can't even go get the mail without getting maced and pepper sprayed. So for the next 2 days, I try to retaliate. I know where she lives. She lives in the complex. So for the next 2 days, the cops are at my place like 3 times. Like, hey, dude, you got to quit going back to her place. She doesn't want to talk to you. Quit trying to make up and make things right with her. Just stay here. I'll never forget why they didn't hook me up and take me in. So, you know, at this point, I'm just, you know, I'm at that point to where I've lost all control, and I was drinking to die. And I had been in and out of the rooms at this point, and my sister has a friend who's in AA, and that friend had called her and said, hey, you know, your brother used to come around once in a while, and we don't see him anymore, and that's kind of a red flag. So I get a knock-knock on my door, and it's my sister. And so this is kind of like my intervention. She comes to my door, and, you know, I'm isolating in my apartment, and I hear the knock on the door. And it's like, in 8 days, this is the first time somebody had come around. And I'm like, oh, cool, company, you know, maybe somebody to talk to, social interaction. So I didn't look it through the people or anything, and I opened up the door, and it was my sister, and that was when I was done. And I had, you know, I went for the next 3 days. I went and detoxed at my mom's house, and I called up my former sponsor, who, you know, for by the grace of God, he didn't fire me for good. And I said, hey, John, it's me again. What do I need to do? I'm ready. And he told me, you know, he went through some things. He said, you need to change It's not just about putting the plug in the jug. You need to change everything. You need to dummy up. Your freaking UCLA degree isn't worth shit. You're just a garden variety drunk like the rest of us, and you need to get into action. And this was on November 4th, 2011 was my sobriety date, but after two or three days of shaking and detoxing it away, I began to get into action. I started going to meetings, you know, I started doing all those things that I wasn't doing before. I started to do the steps and do it, you know, just... Before that, all I was doing was going to meetings, and so I just hung by his side and I listened to suggestions, and I latched on to what the newcomers told or the old timers told me, and I just began to get into action. And I remember at 5 months sobriety, I was in. At this point, I was job hunting finally. I had finally kind of cleared out the cobwebs, and I was kind of reasonably ready to re-enter the workforce. And so I lived in Fresno. I got sober in Fresno, and I came down here. I know Reyes from up there in Fresno, and I was interviewing down here, and each, I had three interviews for the county down here, and each interview I would meet with him and we would talk, and finally the third one, he said to me, you got very few months under your belt. You're going into this promising job. You're going into a new area, and I got an extra room. Do you want to, you know, live here with me? So for 5 months, I lived with Reyes, and, you know, I'm very grateful for that, Reyes. And he kind of led me to the right meetings and kept me plugged in and connected down here in this area. Because, you know, it was a tall order for... Given my past and to have a few months and to enter in the position that I was entering into and the new area, new sobriety, new people and stuff, and it was a challenging time. And I remember at right around this time, my sponsor happened to be traveling off and on frequently, and I knew I needed to get into action and do some step work. So my sponsor, you know, I was doing my fourth and fifth step, and my sponsor said, well, there's really nowhere in the book or in the program that says you have to do your fourth and fifth with me. So we talked about it for a while, and I did my fifth step with Carol. You know, and it was that point to where pain's a great motivator, and I was at that point to where I was in some pain and I needed that relief and that to know, like the fourth column of that fifth step. I spent 5 hours with Carol at her house. One of the greatest things that Carol's known for saying that I think about all the time is read it, write it, talk it, pray it. And she said that to me several times that day when we were talking about things. And, you know, so I started to get into action and do the things that are required in this program. And, you know, I'm living down here. I'm going to meetings. I'm getting plugged in. I'm living with Reyes. And I'm, you know, I'm doing the deal, like we say in Fresno. We always talk about doing the deal. And, you know, and things are going really well. Things, you know, I'm doing well at work. I'm doing, you know, I'm going to a lot of meetings. And I hadn't hit any obstacles or any hurdles in my recovery until I got to the 11th month of my sobriety. And it was October of 2012. And I'm in Porterville, and I'm working, and I'm at a doctor's office, and getting a recorded statement from a doctor, and my, you know, the phone rings, and I just hear, I start to talk, and on the other end is my mom on the other end. Incidentally, my mom is here tonight. I want everyone to know she's my rock through everything I've done, and it's just, it's amazing after all I've done, but she's, I'm amazed at her. And so, I'm in Porterville at this doctor's office, and my mom's on the other end, and I just hear this wailing, screaming sound. And I hear her saying, "He's not going to live. He's not going to live." And the nurse grabs the phone and says, "Kirk, she can't talk anymore. You might want to consider coming up here." And then she explained to me what happened. And she was up at Community Regional Medical Center in Fresno. My brother is a pest inspector, and he was up on a 15-foot-high ladder. He had fell, landed on his head. So he was in the operating room, and he had been coded twice, pronounced dead twice, several hours of surgery. And so I immediately, I'm down in Porterville, I immediately put the tools and the things that I had learned in this program into use. And I popped speaker CDs into my car, and I began to make the trek from Porterville up to Fresno. And I just started calling. I didn't care about the ticket for talking on your phone or any of that shit. I just started calling people on the way up, had a speaker CD in the car, listening to tapes and talking to people, saying, "Man, I can't do this. I can't do this, man. I'm all alone. I can't do this." I get up to Community Regional Medical Center, and I come out of the lobby area, and the surgeon is there, and she's explaining the first battery of, or the first 8 hours or whatever it was of surgery. And she said, "In all my years of experience and being a doctor, I don't think I've ever seen anybody make it through this. And if they do," and my head started to run to that part of my brother, my best friend, my golf buddy is going to be a vegetable. And I started walking the halls. I didn't know what to do. I was all alone, and and it was like AA angels came upon me. The elevator doors opened, and five people from the meetings in Fresno came off the elevator doors and were there, And that's what you guys do. That's what this program does. People are there for people in need. And it was, Sue Ellen and several other people. It was happened on a Thursday night. We spent that whole weekend in the hospital having meetings on the floor, bringing in food. They walked me through this. They kept me through this. And, it was on the weekend of the Fresno Fair. I remember on Sunday, they finally, "You got to get out. Come on, man. You got to have fun. You got to laugh." We went to the Fresno Fair that Sunday, had that, ate that shitty deep fried food that they have at the big Fresno Fair, and we laughed, and I was able to walk through it. And, he's been a miracle. He's recovered from that. He's short-term, memory issues, but he's got his license back. He's fully recovered from that. But one thing it did show me is the power of prayer. There was a lot of people there that were praying with me, and a lot of people in the meetings. And, as I stand here today, I don't think he would have made it if it weren't for the power of prayer. And it's kind of fun now. I still get to go play golf with him. He's got the short-term memory losses, and we'll come walking off the green, and he'll have hit two trees and gone in three lakes and lost five balls. And I'll say, "Would you get on that hole?" And he'll go a four, And I say, "Good job, bro. Keep it up, man. Do it again on the next hole." Got to practice that restraint of tongue, But when I earlier was talking about when I was in, when I was in law school, and I had that delusional, just that delusional mindset that when I was in law school, it was during the time of the O.J. Simpson chase, and right about the time I was taking that final exam in the blackout was during the time of that O.J. chase. And, when I had this, I'm drinking like a fish, I'm like trudging through law school would be an overstatement, and I had this delusional mindset that I was going to be like the next Dream Team member with like Johnny Cochran and F. Lee Bailey and Kardashian and those guys, you know, and I was going to be like, have this goal of being that. But, you know, the thing that I want to emphasize is that, you know, I'm not the person that I wanted to be, and I'm not the person that I aspired to be, you know, but I thank God every day that I'm not the person that I used to be, you know, and that's huge for me as I stand here tonight. And, you know, just one last, you know, wish or hope for all you guys as you kind of trudge that road toward the happy destiny. Just hope that, you know, God blesses you and keeps you to then. Thanks.